I'd like to welcome you here, especially those who came in today and weren't with us last night. We anticipate a lot of people coming throughout the day who didn't come for the entire conference, but wanted to come hear one or two of the speakers. So this year we have the highest number of those who pre-registered that we've ever had, which is... And a lot of those are here for the first time. I mean, a huge number are here for the first time. So I'm anticipating some really interesting talks today and a lot of information and personal stories and so forth. A couple of little things that I need to tell you. The restaurant here in the hotel has, for dinner, kind of gone upscale, but I looked at their lunch menu, and the prices are about what they were last year, so it is a pretty decent place to have lunch, and their food's really good. They can't handle, you know, all of us going there at one time, but to those that want to stay in the hotel, that is a good recommendation for you. Forgot where I wrote my notes. Those who haven't figured it out yet about the parking in the garage, especially I'll have to say this probably two or three times a day from people coming in, but you, when you come in, you go to the garage and you'll get a ticket as you go in, and then you park your car, you come back to the front desk, and they will validate it for the rest of the weekend. You have to tell them that you're here for the conference. And the parking is free for all of us, even those who are not staying in the hotel. And there will be the snacks that were out, breakfast stuff that was out this morning. There'll be some refreshing of that about mid-morning, and we will also have a little snack break in the afternoon in case you decide you don't really want to go out and walk to a restaurant. There will be some snacks here for you. Because we've put the bios in the program, we don't do long biographies of our speakers, but Peter Danzig has been associated with us and his wife Mary also. They have presented beautiful music for us several times, and we actually had almost like a full little mini concert one Sunday morning with them and some other musicians that they were able to wanted to come and perform that for us. So he has had an interesting journey the last few years, and his work that he does now as a therapist and counselor is so valuable for people who have left the church and are looking for somebody, counselor of some sort, who understands where they're coming from. And I'm very anxious to hear what he has to say today. And I'd like to introduce Peter Danzig.
Well, thank you. Can you all hear okay? All right. If anybody can't hear, I'm hearing impaired a little bit. So I know what that's like. I want you to be able to hear. So you can come tell me, or you can, Steve over here, can gently let me know I need to do something to make it hearable. Can you see? That's the other question. If you can see, I don't care. The lights on will keep me awake. Now, a brief moment of testimony. I will say coffee, I think, has done more to make my day better than prayer has ever accomplished. As someone with ADHD, I didn't know the glory of having something to help me focus a little bit. So other warning here, if for those sensitive people, there might be a couple of swear words involved. But I'll try and keep it very tame. The first one is up there. This presentation has evolved radically every time I worked on it. So we've got a lot of ground to cover. I'm going to try and go fast. I'll try and save some time for questions, and then I'll be around Sunday morning and for the rest of the conference if you have questions and want to come talk to me or ask them at the panel discussion. I'm a counselor, an LCSW. I've been doing that for 11 years. I left, resigned my membership in the LDS Church in 2008, and John's got a Mormon Stories podcast. If you're curious about that story, you'll know me better than I know myself if you listen to that. So I may illustrate some things from my own life, but I'm not going to go deeply into my own story. This presentation is meant to be about the work I'm doing now, working with individuals who are leaving the LDS Church and also working with couples who are trying to deal with being on opposite sides of that faith boundary. And the question I've asked myself over and over in my own journey is, why is this so damn hard? Like, I'm a counselor. I should be able to handle this. I should be the most skillful. You know, I know all about healthy family relations, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to address a few things today. One of them is someone last night mentioned that they get asked, why can't you just let it go? So that's we're going to answer that question, why you probably can't just let it go. We're going to talk about some ideas about healing, and then how do we minimize the impact of going through this on family and friends. I wanted to start with this poem, which I'm just going to read to you. If you're not already familiar with it, I think it is one of the best poems to start out a journey like this. It's by Mary Oliver. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds. And there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. I'm going to pass that on to Mary Oliver because it's a beautiful poem. Now, what are we dealing with? So I've looked for a long time for a way to encapsulate precisely the issues that come up in Mormonism. So the first point here is that Mormonism has a performance-based salvation system. You have to perform certain things in order to achieve salvation, and there are threats of social exclusion for nonconformance. Now, this, I think, encapsulates most of the problem, because the human nervous system is wired so that threats to your inclusion in your social group are perceived the same way as physical pain. So when you're being threatened with exclusion, it's the same as if someone is physically threatening you in terms of your neurological response. Witness how many people are frightened of social situations. It's very difficult. So individuals who are unable or unwilling to conform inside of this system are then under constant threat of social exclusion. Now, this may be present. This may be simply that God can't quite handle you up there by him, and you can go way down there with other people. But you're under that threat, and it's perceived the same way physical harm would be. So there's only one word I can come up with for this, which is abuse. This is an abusive thing. Here's the dictionary definition. To treat a person or animal, that would describe humans, I think, with cruelty or violence, especially regularly or repeatedly, as in constant threats to exclusion if you do not conform with us. Note that the definition does not mandate intent to abuse. It simply describes the experience of the abused. So obviously one thing to point out is that inside of a system like this, not everyone experiences abuse the same way. If I happen to be a person for whom conforming comes easily or things just match up for me really well, it happens to be a good fit, I probably don't experience that very much. I don't have a lot to deal with in terms of being worried about being excluded. Now, one of the things I want to talk about is programming that happens to our brains beneath the conscious level inside of Mormonism. And here's a whole list of things. We'll go through them a little bit more thoroughly as we go along. But the point I wanted to make here is these are things that can impact recovery in relationships with others. This is, I found that knowing about these can be very helpful in conceptualizing how do I want to work with other people and how do I want to work with myself as I go through this. I'm going to jump right into the first, and I think possibly, in my mind, the most important one. This is deeply tied to the threat of social exclusion that is tied to the performance-based salvation system. So we have a hardwired fear of social rejection, and we, as Mormons, you undergo a process that the best description I could come up with is worthiness training. So lifelong training in maintaining your acceptability so that you are not excluded. This begins at a pre-verbal stage. So before you're able to articulate anything, you're noticing this family system, this church system, this system that says you must be this way or you will be excluded. Now, what does this result in? It results in people becoming hypersensitive to cues that indicate social rejection. And this is especially prominent when paired with symbols or rituals. So this first, for me, my personal experience is I discovered I just could not behave myself when I went to family events such as a baby blessing. And I felt terrible. I'm a counselor. I'm like, you know, if this were another religion, I'd just go, I'd do my thing, I'd say mazel tov, you know. It wouldn't be a big deal. But I just couldn't go and behave, and I was so confused about it. And what I realized is something was being activated in me that I wasn't consciously in control of. Now, this John brought up something when he spoke last night about being conditioned to see all of us bitter apostates as dark and angry. I will admit to some anger. So we'll get to that. But worthiness training conditions how we view those who have left the system because they're now unworthy. And obviously being considered unworthy means that, I mean, there's some big implications there. So I want you to further explore this. I want you to imagine this sign at the beach. Now, I haven't met a whole lot of beautiful bishops. No, I'm just kidding. The other problem here is that there's some small print that I didn't put on that beauty will be verified on a yearly basis. We're going to check. We're going to check all the way. So who's going to be in the beautiful side here? Well, you're going to have a whole lot of nervous people, right? Like, think I can go over there. I'm pretty sure, but what if someone calls me out? You know, like I didn't check with the bishop to see if I belong. So you're going to have a bunch of nervous people. You're going to have a bunch of people who are fairly confident that, yeah, I match this description. And you're going to have every narcissist on the face of the planet. Every single one. So one problem with this whole system is that it self-selects for narcissism. Like, if you're a narcissist, it's perfect for you. And quite honestly, you probably don't find it very abusive because, I fit. Now, I find this particular example to be helpful because one of the things that's a little hard to get, you know, when you're thinking about why is this such a big deal? Somebody last night said, you know, I feel a little guilty that that it all worked out for me. Okay, I don't have a horrible story of losing my wife and my job. And I have talked to people, you know, they're like, well, why is this such a big deal? Nothing so terrible has happened to me. Well, something really terrible happened to you. You lived with this your whole life. You know, like, am I beautiful enough to be with the beautiful people? Or am I everyone else? Mormon hell. Now, something that took me a very long time to understand for myself and as a counselor is the flip side of worthiness training. We all understand what happens to us when we exit the system. We all understand, probably everyone here has had that moment where, you know, that system got triggered. What I did not understand for a very long time is how this is happening the other way. So family and friends who stay in the church are also hypersensitive to cues of social rejection from in-group. So someone can say to me, I think you're deceived by the devil and are working for the destruction of mankind and God's kingdom. And I can say, I think possibly you're being fooled. And they experience that with the same emotional reaction that I just heard, you're trying to murder God's children spiritually. It's a very odd thing that I didn't quite catch for a long time until I got clear enough to really listen to some family members who were nice enough to be honest with me and say, they started describing their experience of me leaving, and I was like, you're describing what I felt. And that was such a surprise to me that I really started looking at relationships, and when I started working with people, started paying close attention to this. Now, there's another problem here that we'll touch on a couple of times as we go through this, but especially for people who are remaining in the church, their identity is so closely tied to the group, and we'll discuss this dynamic later, that criticism of the church is experienced as criticism of self. This makes conversations very, very difficult because I need to talk about what I'm going through, and that has to do with a system that I see as separate from the individual, but the individual can't really separate those. So when I speak what I'm speaking, that's not generally how it's emotionally perceived. Even if they understand it, that's not how it emotionally impacts them. So let's talk just briefly about lack of ownership of self, because this is a big deal. So I'm moving on from worthiness training into kind of the next issue. In an abusive system, such as we've described here, the self exists to serve the system's needs. And so there's going to be pressure to repress any aspect of the self that does not serve the system's needs. Here, I've listed just a few. I'm sure there's lots more. That's why there's an et cetera at the bottom. If you think of one that I should have included because it was that important, come tell me, and I'll stick it in there for you. Now, this is a tricky thing because, what, where? Need another sip of coffee, folks. Back on track. Okay, all is well. I thought I felt the spirit for a moment. But we've been rescued by a beverage. All right, so that might have sidetracked me again. So this lack of ownership of self, I wanted to mention last night, listening to everybody tell their stories. This, I love listening to those stories because I always imagined kind of this scorched earth and this little crack in the ground and this little this little seed of green coming up through there, this little sprout. And that's what I'm hearing whenever I hear someone say, you know, I woke up, or I just all of a sudden, that self, even though there's concrete and black top and tar laid out over the top of the self to keep it in check, you're the people who just squeezed up through those cracks. That self came out. And that I think is the experience that so many of us have felt, that moment of relief. Like, I don't have to be buried under this system for the rest of my life. I want to talk a little bit about shame. So in an abusive system, shame is cultivated by the system whenever you try to claim ownership of self or meet personal needs in a way contrary to the abusive system's interests. Shame is a tricky one, I think, because shame is like worthiness training. It gets programmed in really deep. So you can redo your cognitions and still find yourself experiencing shame. My thoughts don't need to trigger shame. It's down beneath the verbal level in a place that I can't access just by thinking about that. So we'll talk a little bit later about how to deal with that. But I wanted to just mention, it can kind of interfere with your healing if you're not really aware of it and pay attention to it. Wanted to talk about trauma as well. So some people have extremely traumatic experiences as a result of religious transition, as a result of leaving. Some have experienced the religion as abusive prior to that. Some people are genuinely, I mean, there's no shortage of horrific stories of abuse, because what I'm describing as an abusive system, that's the best case scenario. And obviously it gets worse from there. And so it's a system for which there are no controls for abuse, which there's really no checking for abuse, and in which abuse has frequently been covered up. I've got a quote here about trauma. The essential psychological effect of trauma is the shattering of innocence, a loss of faith that there is any safety, predictability, or meaning in the world, or any safe place in which to retreat. I think many of us simultaneously find ourselves ecstatic at discovering the self and that freedom, and at the same time paradoxically shattered with the realization that there isn't any safety. That is an incredibly difficult spot to be in. So just a couple of things about trauma. Trauma-related symptoms that you might experience are re-experiencing intrusive memories or flashbacks. Emotional states can be flashbacks. So, for instance, I talked about going to a baby blessing ceremony. One of the troubles for me is that my worthiness training program is triggered. I end up with an emotional re-experiencing of rejection, which I maybe don't need to experience at this point anymore, but it's still, boom, it comes up, and I'm re-experiencing it. And guess what? That re-experiencing is just as painful as it was to experience it earlier. So, of course, that's difficult. You may have some fight-or-flight reactions. You may experience physical symptoms. You may have nightmares. Here's my recurring nightmare, Elder Danzig. And I discover I'm on a mission. I haven't had many of those in the past year for years. That was a terrifying nightmare. It's like, how did I get here and what do I do? So the other thing that may happen is some numbing. You may have some emotional numbing. This is a defense mechanism that helps you psychologically pull away from the trauma. Now, the last thing I wanted to mention is just grief and loss issues. Here's a list of wonderful tasks of dealing with loss. You have a loss, even though you have this beautiful gain of discovering the self. At the same time, discovering the self at 35, 40, 70, 15. Like, I was supposed to be discovering myself as a child and then really nailing it down as a teenager. So there's a huge loss there if you're suddenly, it's a gain and a loss at the same time. And you have all these other dilemmas of family relationships, and you have all these realizations of things are not going to work out the way I thought. So now, at the same time, when you, I want to mention with family, when you disclose to them, they're also experiencing loss. So tasks of grief, we'll just go through these really quick. Accept the reality of the loss. This can take a long time, this first task. How big is this? You don't always know how big it is, right? Like I had a family member get in a car wreck recently, and they seemed okay right up front, and afterwards it turned out they were hurt worse than they thought. This can be the same thing up front. You know, you maybe don't know how bad it is. You can have denial, numbness, shock, bargaining. Oh, don't you hate it when your family member is experiencing loss? Start the bargaining. That's very difficult. So these are basically things that help you from experiencing the full. You know, you go to the doctor, they say, tell me, where's your pain scale? These things here are the immediate medication you can take to kind of help yourself not be completely overwhelmed by the pain of the loss. Then you have to work through the pain of the grief. So I want to point out some common emotions: sadness, fear, loneliness, despair, hopeless. Oh man, that's a sad list. I want to go to the next line though: anger. Anger is natural, normal, expectable thing to be going through if you've experienced a loss. And I kind of put this here: anger usually occurs when an individual feels helpless, powerless, abandoned, or betrayed. Now, the interesting thing is, for many of us, for the first time in our lives, we're feeling powerful and empowered. And at the same time, we're confronting things where we are helpless and powerless and abandoned and deeply betrayed. So then we've got to adjust to an environment in which that was which was lost is missing. So once you kind of dealt with the pain, you've worked through enough of the pain of grief to be able to move. So now we're going to, now I like to think of this as the physical therapy moment. Like, okay, so I got injured and I've worked through the pain and now it's time to heal and I'm going to start doing the physical therapy to get back to my best functioning. The problem that happens here is, this is the moment when you discover you missed some of task one. So you're not 100%. You haven't confronted the entire reality of the loss. So for many of us, this is the moment we get to the point where, like, I'm going to tell somebody about what I've gone through. And you discover that they didn't handle it as well as you had hoped. And that, all of a sudden, you're back in task one, right? Like, oh, this was a bigger loss than I thought. The last one down here is find an enduring connection to that which was lost while embarking on a new life. I like the new life part better. The enduring connection still triggers me. Isn't that interesting? Like, for me, like, find an enduring connection to who I was as a Mormon sometimes still makes me feel really threatened. And hopefully someday that settles down for all of us. And maybe for some of you it's already totally settled. So working with family members, we have out-of-phase processes here. So I mentioned this already. You go tell your family member, hello, I've had a faith transition, and I'm dealing with it pretty well, and I thought maybe now was the time to tell you, and they're like, ah! Your father's tearing out his very short hair. What's left of it? So they're confronted with grieving task one, and I'm in grieving task three. This is a little bit of a problem, because what's in grieving task one? Denial. That's how you cope with task one, because you can't do it all at once. It's impossible. So you've got to have some denial, and your family members immediately start bargaining. They immediately start saying, well, isn't there a way that this might not be as big a loss as I feel like it might be? Because it's terrifying for them, too, right? It's not just you who lived with threats of social exclusion. They may have never experienced those threats until that very moment, and all of a sudden, wham, I'm not going to have my family forever. That's an incredibly potent, powerful, difficult moment. And the hardest thing then is that their identity is tied up with the identity of the religion. So they've been trained to look at you as the source of the problem, And nobody wants to blame themselves. And since they're kind of, the self is mixed up with the system, this, it's easy to look outward at someone else. Now, you tell someone and then you're thrown back into phase one. This loss is harder than I thought. So you end up in denial and you end up in bargaining and you want to convince them and you want to see if isn't there some way to change it. Can't I make you leave the church with me? Can't I make you see my point of view? And the biggest problem that happens here with grief and loss issues is that what each of you need to heal is contradictory to what's going to be helpful to the other person. Each of you need a chance to have some denial. Each of you need a chance to do some bargaining. Each of you are going to need a chance to be angry. But you know what? It's going to hurt each other if you point it at each other. You're going through the exact same thing on opposite sides. So that's just the last point. You get together with someone you love, and the things that you need could be harmful to each other. Another piece of grief and loss is that this is an ambiguous loss, right? There's no, here we have a beautiful thing, which is this is a social support ritual for dealing with this loss. So to the people who founded this, Sue and Kath and Steve and everybody helping make this happen, thank you. This is incredibly important to have a conference like this because it's incredibly important to have social support systems. It's incredibly important to have a moment where everybody can get together, and if you haven't tried alcohol, here's a supportive group of people who are going to help you into this new world. Because there's this ambiguity to it. Someone dies and everyone comes over and there's a funeral. There's a whole structure to dealing with that loss, and there's no structure to dealing with this loss. So for those people building that structure, thank you. The other thing is it can be difficult or taboo to discuss. This thing happens to your family members too, right? Like who do they call to say, guess what? My spouse doesn't believe anymore. It's getting a little better because it's happening a lot and people are having to talk about it, but that's a big deal. Like you may not have anyone to talk to. Lack of clear, accurate information about the loss. This is a huge problem, especially for your family members and friends in the church. They don't have very good information about this loss. They have very poor information about this loss in general. And then there's a lack of clear indicators of closure, which make it difficult to proceed. So for instance, with your family members, like, how do they know this is never going to change? That's really hard. I have a little slide on resignation, but it's one of the reasons I think resignation is a useful tool, because it is a very clear indication of closure. I think family members understand they resigned and they don't believe, and I can't ask them to get rebaptized because that wouldn't work. So it helps with that closure piece sometimes. And it's painful for everybody, but it can provide a sense of closure both for yourself and for family and friends who are not, you know, that kind of sets a final boundary that is difficult to come back across. Now, the last piece of unconscious stuff that might be going on is, I wouldn't pay too much attention to this slide. It's got heavy scientific-sounding quotes. Predictive coding. So I'm going to just bounce on to the next one to explain it. Basically, what that says is our brains tend to kind of look out at a situation, predict what it's going to be, and then notice the details. So in a very real sense, you perceive the forest before you perceive the trees. Maybe the best example is I'm driving through the forest around Lake Tahoe, and my brother-in-law says to me, look at that. And I look at a tree, and I'm not very interested. And he says, no, wait, really, look at it. So I really look at it, and it's not a tree. It's a cell phone tower. Pretty obviously a cell phone tower disguised as a tree. But because my brain expects a forest, I don't notice it, not one lick. Now, if you set that out in my front yard, I'm never, ever going to think it's a tree. So how does this work for this? you're likely to miss important details. Our brains have some predictive coding. We have been acculturated to think that we're going to be rejected. We have a whole system of training that's been installed to think that we're going to be rejected. We've dealt with trying to avoid rejection our entire life, and now we're confronting that, and your brain is going to automatically filter out things that don't match that perception, unless they rise to a significant level. Now, it's a little bit much to expect that your family or friends will know that the shy smile or the pat on the back or the small little thing that they're doing is not going to be noticed, and to expect them to greatly exaggerate everything they're doing that's at all accepting of you. That you could ask them to. That's not a bad idea. But it's a little difficult. Now, in terms of healing, this is also a problem. Self-fulfilling prophecies. There's some research, interesting research that shows that things you're afraid of are more likely to happen to you. It's just because your brain, this is the predictive coding effect. You're seeing how it might happen. You're seeing that, and you're more likely to fall into that pattern. So when I first really began confronting that I needed to maybe step out of this system of the Mormon Church, I was in a small town working as a counselor, and one of the really frustrating things I saw was, like, either in some of these small towns, pretty much either you were an active Mormon or you were an alcoholic. And I really wondered about that. That seemed so strange to me. I thought, now, I think it speaks to the abuse, like, you got to cope somehow. But I think it also speaks to the fact that this was the expectation, and it can be very difficult to buck that expectation. And it's one of the things to watch for yourself as you go through this. How much impact are these unconscious predictive things, how are they impacting you? What if you have a misfortune and there's still that underlying thing that says that misfortune is because you misbehaved? So watch out for that as you're healing. There are some cross-boundary myths that make talking to family hard. So the idea that faith transition is due to laziness or transgression, that can be really difficult to deal with because that's what they're going to see. And from the flip side, believing that people can't be accepting, I will tell you, I work with a lot of couples who are on opposite sides. And one of the things that surprises me is when I get a couple in and the person who's left cannot at all see how accepting their spouse who is staying inside is. I've met some really beautiful people who have been, it's been a very healing experience for me because I'm dealing with my own predictive coding that says I will be rejected. And I get to see these, it's not my own situation, so I'm not getting triggered. And I've spent a long time trying to clear myself enough to deal with it. And I'm seeing these people who are being remarkably accepting, who are just, and sometimes the other family member cannot see it at all. So watch out for that. I wanted to talk really briefly in this context about commonly misread emotional cues. So I tell my spouse that I don't think I believe in the church anymore. I might want to leave. And immediately, they're very anxious. Obviously, with good reason. Now, anxiety doesn't look on the face that different from rejection, right? And I'm expecting rejection. That's what I'm worried about. And so what I see is this person's rejecting me, and what they're experiencing is, so that's an interesting one. The other one is my feeling of being judged does not look, what my facial expressions when I feel judged are not very different from the facial expressions that I experience when I feel shame. So I'm upset about being judged, and I maybe am avoiding eye contact. I'm maybe being defensive. And if I felt ashamed, I might also react in very similar ways. So these are things that it's important to talk about because they can be misperceived. So we're going to move on to some tools for healing all of these things. And that's the heading, so let's just jump right in. I wanted to offer another Mary Oliver quote. She's my favorite poet. Here's the quote. You do not have to be good. It's the first line of a poem called Wild Geese. What I want to tell you is that if you're thinking, I have to do this right, I have to exit the church right. I have to deal with my family right. That is the Mormon inside of you. I'm telling that person, you do not have to be good. You have to be who you are. That's how come you're here instead of there, is because you have to be who you are. So just don't worry about it. And the real truth is, you might be having a really difficult time. You might have gone through something horrific and be really struggling. So you can't really expect yourself to do something perfect. So the first step is accept where and how you are. Don't try and change things you can't. Don't try and imagine that, oh, you know, that whole worthiness training thing, I have so perfectly dealt with that. It never comes up for me. It never bothers me. Because it's just probably going to come up. That's probably just going to happen. Your reactions, some of them are hardwired. You can retrain some of them, but some of them are just going to pop up for you. 20 years from now, you might discover. So, next thing is, you're dealing with loss. It's hard. And you're probably going to be angry. And anger is okay, because anger is your friend. Now, we might talk a little bit about how to utilize anger in a healthy way versus a destructive way. But if you need to be a little destructive, that's okay. All right, last thing, are you dealing with trauma? You might want to pay some attention to that, because not everyone has the same level of trauma. Not everyone experiences the same level of abuse inside the system. And those who experience abuse don't always experience it as traumatically as others. It's just a differential thing, different for each person. So the first thing we want to do is measure and observe. Just start to notice what's going on for yourself. Begin to watch your emotions. Begin to watch your reactions. I notice people, I'm going to interject here, take all the pictures you want, and I will also post this. So if anybody wants the whole thing later to review, or your picture turned out blurry, or you just want me not in the picture, all of that's okay. Develop a good emotional vocabulary, because that can be helpful. You want to be as articulate about your inner world as possible. I recommend using an emotion thermometer, a scale of 1 to 10 to measure emotions. 1 is like, this is great, I can handle it, the emotion's not bothering me. 10, well, here, I'll flip to the next slide. 10 is call 911. You want to pay attention to what triggers these very strong emotional reactions. And you want to measure how fast your reactions climb this emotional scale. Like, do you suddenly rocket from a 3 to a 7? That you want to know what things do that to you. I'm going to point out, most people begin to lose control around 7 to 9. So you got at 7, you got, oh my gosh. And you can see it only gets worse from there. About the moment you get past, oh my gosh, pretty much your skill level is gone, because you've entered a fight or flight reaction. So you're no longer in rational control of what you're doing, probably, if your emotions are that high. Your brain evolved this as a way to escape polar bears. And it works very well for that. It doesn't always work really well with your family member. And we're going to talk about how to make it work a little better with them. Because the problem is, you might need to kill the polar bear, or you might need to never see the polar bear again in some way, shape, or form. Or you might need to lie very still while it kind of tears you apart a little. None of those are a good idea with family. So the last thing you want to pay attention to, whether or not you think you have trauma, is what triggers you. What triggers these strong emotional reactions? So here are a few things that might, and there's a whole list of others that I'm sure you could add, but worthiness, unworthiness cues, I find all the time. This is a huge trigger for people. I'm going to put facial expressions there. Does anyone know the bishop stare? They're like, I'm assessing your worthiness stare. Oh, I had somebody try that on me right in the midst of my whole thing. I almost kicked him. You know, I was just like, I couldn't believe I went from I'm so glad to see you to I want to kill you. Like, boom! And I was a little astonished, you know, because I'm a counselor and I've worked through it. It's why I'm a pacifist, because I think, you know, I don't need any practice at wanting, nobody really needs any practice at wanting to kill people. Like, that's kind of built in, right? Like, so rituals can be difficult. Words or phrases can also be difficult. Symbols, decorations. I talk to so many people who tell me, I felt fine, and then I walked in the house, and there was the temple, and there was the quote from so-and-so, and there was the picture of a poor person being abused who has dementia, but they're making him work and give talks at conference. And so, this maybe is the moment to mention it. So yesterday something said something about Elder Anderson's talk that included Give Joseph Smith a Break. And I thought, that sounds interesting. I didn't pay attention to conference at all. I thought, I better Google this. So I start typing in what is his name? Anderson? And I get the A, and Google shows a suggested search, elder abuse. I was like, I think that's the general authority I met with. So anyway, there we have that. Now, the next thing you might want to think of is volume knobs. Everyone's used, or anymore, we've got volume sliders. But some of you look old enough, you might remember knobs. if you've got a predictive coding error, which is, I'm going to go talk to my family member and my brain thinks they're going to reject me, you need to, number one, say, any rejection I experience, I need to mentally try and turn that down. I need to try and mentally adjust, okay, it felt like a 10, I'm just going to knock it down 3 notches to a 7. I can maybe deal with the 7. Now, this doesn't necessarily solve your internal emotion, but over practicing this can be very helpful. The other thing is you need to turn up the knob. You need to go, I am looking for any cue that I'm accepted, and I'm going to turn that way up. Now, you can ask your family members to work with you on this. You can say, hey, I don't notice when you show me that you care about me. And if you would point it out or exaggerate it a little bit, that might be helpful for me. And I'm going to try and do the same. And you might have this conversation in the reverse works really well, too, because your family member might be having the same problem. Now, I think that covers that. Setting boundaries. You're going to need to set some boundaries because part of healing, part of the problem is you had no boundaries. You were in an abusive system that stole your boundaries. And you have to set some boundaries. You have to claim the space that you need for you to grow. You have to tear up what's on top of you and set it aside. So here's just some real tips for setting boundaries. Describe your situation. That's really helpful for your family member to say, when this happens, so when you ask me to pray, when I go to church, or when you say, express your emotion, here's what I'm feeling, set the boundary, I don't want to feel that way, so here's how I want to do it instead. Now, here's a consideration that you don't find in most boundary setting things, but I'm going to mention it to you. Avoid triggering their worthiness training. This is very important because setting a boundary, we want to especially avoid. So one of the things to try and do is just own this yourself. You may need to blame the church. Go find a friend that you can rant to on the phone after you set. Or go to coffee with somebody. Okay, I feel better. I thought I felt the spirit again. So let them know unconditional love is incredibly important. Let them know you don't have to do anything for me. I'm going to take care of myself. And I'm doing that because I need to, because I'm worried about how I'll behave if I'm so upset. And I don't want to hurt you. And it's fine. I usually say, don't steal their hope. Say, hey, I hope it's not this hard in the future. I hope maybe I hope someday I could come sit in church with you for a few minutes and not be all freaked out and make enemies of everybody and be passive aggressive for 2 weeks afterwards. So avoid long discussions if emotions are high. So if you're above a 7, you want to just gracefully exit. If you're at a 7 and you think it might go up because you've been watching your triggers and that's part of the reason for paying attention is how long can I stay in a manageable place and when can't I? When you know that, then you can just gracefully try and get out right before it happens. Say, hey, this is bad. I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to feel upset and I need a break. Is there a clock somewhere? Shut me up if I go too long. appropriate distancing. I should have put versus avoidance. Now, avoidance can get to be a problem, right? But appropriate distancing is something you'll have to work on. So we've already mostly talked about this, but the key piece here is notice what you can't deal with skillfully and don't try and tackle that. Now, I started running a while back because I was getting fat, and I thought it might be nice to be outside. And I trained and eventually ran a half marathon and didn't quite die. Now, I couldn't have run a full marathon. That just wasn't a possibility at that time. And this is what you need to pay attention to for yourself. What are you trained for at this point? What can you handle emotionally? Where are you at? Don't try and tackle something you can't handle. If you can't handle it, get out of the situation. And then you can sit down and strategize for, I want to handle this. It's okay to train for a marathon. Don't run a marathon untrained. That's this. Now, if you are in public settings, I find for people who need to go somewhere with a believing family member, this is important. You may need to go with them. You may want to go with them. You may feel like, I want this to work. Have a couple of escape plans ready. So cell phones are wonderful this way. You can suddenly receive a text that you didn't receive. Remember, you don't have to be good, which means to the public, I would suggest that you let your family member know if they're close to you, that you're handling things this way so they don't wonder what horrible thing happened that you had to run out for. But you can just get called away. There's no reason you can't, and you don't owe anyone an explanation, and you could just not feel well. You could just, if you're somewhere and it's not working out, you could just have an emergency and leave, and you don't need to tell people why. Now, reclaiming ownership of self, this is important work that we all have to do. Now, I put the re in parentheses. I read all this recovering from cult literature, and it all talks about, you know, reclaiming the self. And I'm like, I did not really get a chance to claim myself in the first place. So I'm not sure there's any re about this. It's sort of like, you know, I left the church, and I'm like, why do I feel like I'm a teenager again? You know, so you need to begin exploring what you want in all the following areas. Your body. How many people here had a weird adult first-time experience of underwear shopping? Yeah. You probably need someone to talk to about it, too, you know, because it's a weird thing. And there are not many people who can understand this, you know. So I suggest we develop a social ritual of helping people with their first time out, you know, just like... But you got to figure out what you want. You didn't get to choose your underwear. That's how invasive this is, right? Like, nobody can see it, but it's still important. Except you can all see it, and I'm going to make sure. No, anyway. Here's some things you might be exploring. Hairstyles, colors. I was like, I'm so grateful I got out before I went bald. I've always wanted long hair. I got a chance. You may need to experiment with all of these things to just sort of see. You didn't maybe get a chance to do this. And sexuality, incredibly important because there's so much repression around that and so much abuse about that in the church. One thing I'm going to mention that I didn't get to earlier that I think is incredibly important, and it's one of the things that really clued me into there being a problem when I was first going through training as a counselor. I was just reading statistics, and this particular statistics I was reading was talking about consequences of sexual abuse as a child for females. And I was reading through this and discovered that it said in teenage years, approximately 50% of females who have been sexually abused end up with many sexual relationships. And that was part of them processing the experience. And I suddenly realized that stigmatizing sex was re-abusing people who'd been abused. This just infuriated me because now all these poor people are going into their bishop trying to talk about it. Instead of processing that they were abused, they get abused by an authority who makes them feel ashamed of process of healing. And that's one of the biggest problems of Mormonism is so often people end up feeling ashamed of healing. So sexuality, same thing happens obviously with individuals who have an orientation other than Mormon trademarked perfect family forever, second wives only in the hereafter. To be looked forward to by all the narcissists. Time, resources, hobbies, interests, self-care, your mind and your soul, ideas, movies, music, books, education, spirituality if you want it, no spirituality if you don't want it. And one thing I didn't mention here that I think is important is speech. So I had to learn to tolerate the distress of swearing in public. So, I mean, that's kind of a tricky thing. It's silly. I was extremely repressed. I'll admit. I grew up with a terrible, debilitating anxiety disorder called Mormonism. So resigning from membership, I wanted to put this out there. It's a powerful way of exploring ownership of yourself. You don't have to resign. Obviously, everyone needs their own path. But when I went through my experience, occasionally people would ask me, well, why did you resign instead of letting them excommunicate you? And the real reason for me was that I needed to claim ownership of that process. I needed at that point for me to be the one making the decision, not for somebody else to be deciding it. Now, if there had been a powerful benefit that I thought I could have handled in a PR sort of way to managing that as an activist, that might have been fine. And people choose that all the time. And some people need the experience of different ways of handling it, of staying in, of being excommunicated. There's nothing wrong with it, but I did want to mention, I thought we owe a debt to the people who sued the church to make it so we could resign. I wanted to go back here and just talk briefly about being aware of exploring yourself. I'm going to go through. Dealing with shame. So shame can interfere. As you're exploring yourself, you've got to watch for shame. So let's talk about shame. If you're feeling any shame, start with a logical analysis of whether the issue you feel shame about is harming anyone. Check this out with trusted friends. Don't vet it against where you got the shame from. Check it out with somebody. Now, if it is harming someone, you're not feeling shame. You're feeling regret. Just fix it. Just deal with it and fix it. If it's not harming anyone, you're probably dealing with shame. Here's a great quote about shame. Shame is the result of an abusive system successfully projecting its guilt onto the individuals being abused. I use this one. This is where I think anger is helpful. When I feel shame, I go to this idea, and it makes me angry. It makes me angry that I am feeling ashamed because somebody else did something to me. That anger can really help you deal with the shame. So anger is an incredibly important tool because you got to fight this shame. Here's how you fight shame. Go find the thing that makes you feel ashamed and do it over and over and over again until it goes away. So I'll give you a brief example from my own life. I've been out of the church for a while, and the president gets on TV, and he's not the president of the church, president of the U.S. And he says, you know, I think some people are so scared of me that they wouldn't even want to have a beer with me. And I thought, I'm not scared of you, I'm scared of the beer. I'm not sure I could do that. What if the president calls and he wants to have a beer? And I'm like, the whole time I'm like, oh my gosh, can I drink this beer? What's going to happen? How do I handle this? I thought, I have got to learn to drink beer in case the president calls. And it wasn't easy because first I had to tell my spouse that I was going to buy a beer, right? Now, one of the things I'm going to suggest to you in dealing with your family is be as open as possible. They feel betrayed, and it's not helpful to do things behind their back. It's better to just let them know how big their loss is. It's better to just let them know, and let them know you're there for you, and that you won't go any faster than you absolutely have to, because they might need you to wait on some things, and you might be able to. And they might need you to wait on some things and you might not be able to. I see it all the time. People need to reclaim ownership of themselves. And the first thing people usually go for is coffee. Because coffee's healthy and it's helpful and it's better than prayer. And so they go for coffee and then there's this huge, like, they can't explain why it's so important to them sometimes. I think it's helpful if you can explain why it's important. I have to feel like I own my own body. I've ascertained this is not going to harm me. It's not going to harm you. It's not going to harm anyone. And I need to reclaim my body and I have to experiment. And coffee is safe. I'm not going to drunk drive. I'm going to drive with extra attention. I'm going to be awake. I'm going to multitask. Wait, well, no. Anyway, so it's important maybe to let them know, because you know what? If you sneak behind and they find out you've been sneaking to Starbucks, and they have predictive coding that says you're going to also sneak out to another woman or man or animal. This fits the scenario, doesn't it? First it's coffee, and then they have the energy for the rest. That's why God forbids it. So be as open as you can with the people that you care about that it impacts. But then go ahead and do it. Confront that. I don't feel too much come up in me when I go to buy beer anymore. And so that's the little speaking about shame. Now, working across faith boundaries with grief and loss issues. I already mentioned be as open as possible. Take some risks. I will tell you this. It'll probably go better than you think if you're willing to look at it carefully. And if you're willing to notice the little things that your brain wants to miss. Watch out for worthiness training issues. So you're going to watch inside yourself, but especially with your family and friends. Watch out. Express unconditional love. Try not to blame. I know it's so hard. You feel so frustrated. Try not to criticize the church to them because their identity is tied up in it. Their identity, the parking lot of the church has been laid over their self. And so when they think of themselves, the church is a piece of them. And when you criticize it, the way they experience it is experiencing a criticism of self. So just keep that in mind. It's sometimes better to say, hey, it looks like this conversation, the things that I need to process are hurting you. I really don't want to hurt you. If you feel like you have energy to hear about it, that'd be great. But if you don't, I noticed you. Notice when your family seems to be at a 7 or above and back off. Like, be kind to them if you can. Other thing to do for yourself, you're going to be angry. The anger we've already talked about is good. It helps you fight shame. It helps you step up. It helps you do things. But with your family member, be vulnerable. Say, hey, I feel really hurt. I feel really betrayed. It's me feeling that. I'm not saying, now your family members are going to hurt and betray you because everyone hurts and betrays somebody. It happens. So when you feel threatened, try to be vulnerable. And the last thing is apologize and take a break. So in a fight, this is one of the marriage counseling tips. In a fight, you have about 1.5 minutes before it becomes completely useless. So if you're above a 7, just there's no reason to talk about it. You're in fight or flight mode. And that's great if you need to kill your spouse. But it's not great if you want to live together for a long time. It's not great if you want to rescue your relationship. So it's okay to say, hey, I'm way out of control. I need a break. I've got to stop. I can't handle this. Get support for processing your anger. You're going to have to. I just can't emphasize this enough. You're going to have to be angry. Anger, I want to touch on this briefly. Anger really activates it. Have you noticed? That's what I think a family member said to me. Just don't be so angry. Anger really triggers worthiness training because anger is a cue that I'm not okay with something in you. And so worthiness training teaches people who are inside the church that, well, if someone's mad at me, maybe that triggers that whole, am I not worthy? Are you telling me I'm not worthy? Are we not going to, this whole cascade of emotions. It's why I think Mormonism in general is anger phobic, and that's why it becomes passive aggressive. You can't do anything openly because it triggers everyone. So if you need to get your anger out, you have to sneak around behind and stab them in the back. Because then at least, you know, they didn't get triggered and say, you're being a bad person because you're being angry and you're telling me I'm a bad person, you know that spiral. Last thing I want to put here is it gets better. I think we need an it gets better video campaign. So if anybody's up to the task, there's already lots of it out there, but it really gets better. The longer you go with this, it's just, life is so awesome. Where are we at time-wise? Okay. We got time for a couple of questions. I was going to show you a song, but I'm not going to. I'm also a musician. I have some songs that are kind of related to... Song? Okay. All right. This was really sparked by my work around the grief and loss tasks associated with transitioning. So I will play this for you. I won't sing it because that would be silly with the computer. I'd feel silly, but... Oh, you so nailed it. Oh, I went past it. All right, how do I get this song to play? There it is.
When it goes, it will leave your heart empty, no blood on your cross. No tablets of stone. It might be cold. Without the promise of redemption, you'll have to get by on your own. Don't turn back for what you couldn't find. There's no heaven dwelling in the past. Face your heart. And if the field is fallow, see what grows when it goes. Don't try to trade the seeds of your sorrows, they lie in that field. Now harrowed and sown, the tender stem, though slow to root, with time begins to grow. Face your heart, and if the field is fallow, see what grows when it goes. See what grows when it goes.
It looks like we have, like, no seconds left.
Yeah, 2 minutes.
2 minutes. All right. So I'm going to put my contact information up here. I'll post this on my website, on my blog, that I don't write on as often as I ought to. And then you can also find our music. I brought some CDs if anybody wants to purchase them. They're over there. There are a few more recovery-themed songs because I'm a songwriter and that's what came out. Do we have... And I want to, yes, thank you. This is my beautiful wife, Mary. The It Gets Better video is that we were on opposite sides of this for, 4 years. Life is really beautiful. That was her playing the fiddle and singing beautifully on that recording. And I guess I better wrap up. Is there time for one question or should we just... One question, ooh. All right, go for it.
This song was talking about when it goes and looking to the future, not looking back. When you leave when you're much older, you look at the future and you go, there's not much left. It's downhill in a lot of ways. So it's really hard to look to the future. You don't see a lot there.
Well, you know, I think for me this song is a little bit more about looking to the present. Like just saying, okay, here I am. I need to be open to what's here. So I think hopefully it can speak to what you just asked about. So the question was, what do I do if I'm older and the future doesn't look very long? Did I get that right? Well, you know what? You don't have the future. You have the present. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things inside of Mormonism. Everything's about the future because everything's about the system and its needs. And so there is no real, you get desperately impaired in your ability to sit with the present, love the present, be in the present. And all you have really is this one precious moment at a time where you can exist and breathe. And that's beautiful, I think, all the way up until it's gone. And who knows what happens then? I don't know, and I'm glad not to. So, all right, thank you very much.